It's a thing that provokes our curiosity. There's a number of questions, and I might not be able to answer all of your questions this morning. It's also a distressing picture. And mostly today we're going to look at the world before the flood, immediately before the flood. Yes, there's some good men calling on the name of the Lord. That's what we looked at last week from chapter 5. Good men called on the name of the Lord. That great specimen of a good man, Enoch, who walked with God and was taken, didn't go through the gateway of physical death itself. But the majority are not. And increasingly so, the majority are not calling on the name of the Lord. So God sees a world of evil. He sees evil, in fact, everywhere. See that in verse 11 and 12. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all people on earth had corrupted their ways. And then back to verse 5. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The writer says, God looked, and what did he see everywhere? Universally, he saw evil into every corner of life, into every household, into every family, to every place. At all ages, he saw evil, evil intent, evil action. And the point is that evil is corrupting and corrupted. There's an idea here that the evil behavior is both corrupt, like it's bad in itself, but also that it's corrupting, that it makes things bad. It's like rotten things making other things go rotten. God sees a world that's corrupt and corrupting. It's a busted world. He says it's a corrupt world and a world that's full of violence. What's the outworking of a busted up world? Well, it's violence. And the word that's used for violence can refer to physical violence, oppressing people, beating people up, killing people, or it can refer to harming people psychologically. It can be talking about individuals harming other individuals. It can be talking about nations oppressing other nations. And God looked and he saw, what kind of world is it? It's corrupt and it's violent. Not as bad as it could be. We'll see that in a minute. But fatally bad, willfully bad. It's not like men seem very worried about it. And godlessly bad. It's a bit like water that's been poisoned. You wouldn't say of a glass of water that every single atom, every single molecule is poison. It's not all poison, but if a glass of water is poisoned, it's poisoned. And the whole thing is poison, completely corrupted. It may have a lot of poison in it, it may have a little bit of poison in it, but it's poisoned. And God says, this is my view of the world as he looks out on men and women after the fall, before the flood. So there is evil everywhere, and he says that judgment is inevitable. It says that God grieved. See that in verse 6. The Lord was grieved that he made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. This is not the grief of a whoops. That was a terrible mistake I made by creating men and women. It's not that kind of a I've made a mistake grief. It's saying out loud for our benefit that things are wrong and I have to act. That things must change because people have rebelled. It's kind of a term that could even be used about books not being balanced. God looks out and he sees that the books are not balanced, and he sees that he has to act to balance the books, to put things right. Judgment's inevitable. Why did judgment come here and now at this time of the flood? We know from immediately after the flood that it didn't get rid of evil. Because bad stuff happens immediately after the flood, and of course right through to our day. So the judgment didn't come to completely wipe out evil. Why did the judgment come? Maybe there was a particular intensity of evil. Maybe part of the judgment was a restriction of people's lifespans. As God says, I will not contend with man forever. I will not rest with man forever. His life will be 120 years. That might be referring to lifespans. It might be referring to how long until the flood. But maybe it's about restraining evil in some way, this judgment. But I think more than anything, it's an expression of God's wrath against sin. But it's not a complete expression. It's a foretaste of judgment to come. It's about demonstrating God's justice and God's wrath at this crucial moment in the history of the world, that God is not complacent, that God is not uncaring about sin. It demonstrates his justice, that he cares, that he grieves, that it causes him pain, that he must act in judgment. So it tells us that. And it's also a foretaste, a forerunner, a little sample, big though it is, of the final, complete, ultimate judgment and wiping out of evil. So there's evil everywhere, and judgment is inevitable. And then we see these human evil alliances. Probably like me when I first looked at this, and this morning as I look at it again, verses 1 to 4 are slightly confusing, aren't they? What is going on in verses 1 to 4? The sons of God saw the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them that they chose. Let me give you some options. One option is that the sons of God are angels. Could be. That is an expression used for angels elsewhere in the Bible. And so you have this rather exotic idea of angels kind of roving around outside heaven, maybe taking bodies or not clear, and kind of spying on an attractive woman and marrying them. Lots of theories, lots of websites talk about this, lots of learned books talk about it as well. But it's kind of a mixture of sort of pop science, science fiction, speculation, and rather obscure theology from things that aren't even in the Bible. Some people talk about aliens, yes, Christians talk about aliens. Well, maybe these were aliens. Not a lot of biblical support for that, generally speaking. Now, we can't rule out that it could be angels, not anything crazy like aliens, but can't rule out that it could be angels, but it doesn't seem to fit with what's being spoken about here. It doesn't seem to fit with the rest of the Bible, and it seems much more at home with ancient mythology than it does with biblical theology. It seems much more at home in the sort of realm of entertainment than really understanding about God. You know, this is a great story to make into a film. This is a science fiction topic. This is a horror topic, films like The Omen. It's much more at home with that than it really is with biblical theology. So it could be angels, and some Christians have thought that it is angels, but I don't think it does mean that. Another theory is that it could be kings. The sons of God are just kings who are taking, like, the first night rites on the wedding night. So as sort of oppressive rulers, they just go around and sort of ladies on their wedding night, the king gets the right to sleep with them first or something like that. Could be referring to that. Obviously that's an evil, distasteful thing that God could see. So it may be referring to that. But I think more likely is the third idea around about this, which is that the sons of God are people of the line of Seth, people of the line of faith, God-fearing people who lose the plot, humans who become predatory, human men who should be serving God, they're sons of God, they're created by God, perhaps they are actually in the physical line of Seth, so humans who lose the plot of serving God and worshipping God and being married within the framework of loving God, and they just rove around marrying whoever they fancy and showing by that they really couldn't care less about the worship of God. What they're really into is the worship of self, the worship of lust, the worship of sex, the worship of power. Get a hint of that verse 4, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterwards. When the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them, they were the heroes of old, men of renown. Now, if you're into the sci-fi theories, you say, well, there's some great, you know, genetic mix-up here, and giants are created by these unholy unions. But I think more likely, because these Nephilim are around later as well in the book of Numbers, more likely it's saying this: people are looking for solutions in sex and in power. Powerful rulers are produced by these unions, fighting men, heroes, people who are feared and who are respected, and that's how men think they're going to sort the world out, by having heroes. Men of renown, men of valor, fighting men. We're going to fight our way to make the world a better place. So that's what I think it means. Some who should be calling on God are now just calling on women. They're producing great warriors. They're pursuing salvation in lust, in sex, in power, in powerful families, in powerful tribes. And the consequence is that until we get to Noah, who's the exception, no one is walking God's way. No one is walking God's way. They're all walking in their own direction, looking at their own solutions, trying to find their own salvation. So God sees a world of evil. What do you see? It's not quite the same, our world, but it's pretty much the same. Is that a fair description, though, of our world? The thoughts, the intents, the actions of everyone are evil all the time. It's a challenge, isn't it, to think, do I see the world like God sees the world? As I look around the world, is this a fair description of the world? And of course, you can only answer that if you have God's eyes. Because it's not like God says it and I've got to decide, yeah, do I agree with that or don't I agree with that? What you've got to say is, if God says it, I've got to look through God's eyes and see that, yes, there are good things, as God will commend good things. Yes, there are good things that God has made. Yes, the world is not as bad, as evil as it could be. God restrains sin. God is gracious in many ways. Yes, that is true, but yes, people thoroughly have turned away from God. They do good stuff in God's grace, but actually their direction, their focus, their purpose, their goal is away from God. This is our world. I was wandering around Brighton on Friday. Sounds a bit weird, doesn't it, wandering around Brighton? So I was lost or something, but just had an afternoon out. And going to Brighton is so entertaining, isn't it? For all kinds of reasons. Not just the seaside and the shops. And I'm wandering around thinking, what's wrong with cultural diversity? Because cultural diversity is good in many ways. It's great to see different colours and styles and shapes of people as you walk around a town like Brighton. It's great to see the variety that God has made of personality and expressions of being a human. Do I condemn that society? That kind of society, that kind of diversity? What is wrong with that? Well, what's wrong with that is when that ignores God. There's nothing wrong with seeking to be who God has made us. There's nothing wrong with expressing the variety that God has made. But if our goal is serving self, serving lust, serving sex, serving power, hero worship, if that is the goal, then any culture is bad. Whether it has lots of different shapes and sizes or just one shape and size. And every expression of culture that steps outside of God's will and says, I don't want to follow God's way, I want to follow my way. Give me this man, give me this woman, give me this thing that I want. Every time culture steps outside of God's plan, then culture is evil. What's the attraction of variety becomes the ugliness of perversity. That's what our world is like. How do you feel about it? You know, I can raise my voice and I can condemn our society in many ways, but how do you feel about our world? We can mess around with the words a little bit about God grieving and quite what he meant and did he feel emotion and all those things, but it says God felt pain. It must mean something. How do you feel about an evil world? How do you feel when you see things, when you experience things which are clearly expressions of evil, of people saying, I don't care about God, I just want to follow myself. How do you feel about it? Does it cause you pain? We can become immune to it all, can't we? Stop grieving as God grieves. Stop feeling the pain that God feels. Stop feeling the sense of injustice. We need to feel outrage. We need to feel a sense of justice. We need to feel a sense of pain at a world busted up. Because how is the world without the rule of God? We get a great explanation of this here. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all people on earth had corrupted their ways. So God says, I'm going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. A corrupted society, a society that says, couldn't care less about God, just want to follow my own thoughts and desires, becomes a violent society. You see, turning away from God, liberating people from the worship of God, doesn't make them free to be better people. It releases them to be as bad as they want to be. Turning away from God doesn't result in a safer or a more caring society. Just think about our society. Now, of course, when we were a more Christian society, there were hypocrisies, there were bad things that happened. There were things that weren't Christian. Of course there were. But in the main, following the general line of things, are we now a more caring society as a secular society, as a godless society? We pride ourselves on the welfare state, but people are still poor and hungry. We pride ourselves on human rights, but we're still so intolerant and critical. We talk about communities, but so many people are isolated. So many young people so depressed that they want to commit suicide. So many old people lonely, wanting someone to just bump them off so they're not a nuisance anymore. We're greedy, we're exploitative, we kill babies, we kill unwanted parents, we're frightened to play in the streets, we're frightened to walk at night. For all our talk about democracy, just a few people control the world and they exploit the rest, the weak and the vulnerable. You see, it's not like being liberated from God makes the world a better place, it makes the world a more dangerous place, a more violent place. And Genesis 6 helps to underline that for us. So what do we need? We need the grace of God. See that in verse 8. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Just as everything seems hopeless, just as the tide of evil seems to have risen to such a point that you just think the only thing is God's going to wipe out everything, as he says, and there's no hope for anyone. Just as it gets to that rising point, that highest point of evil, God intervenes in grace. Wham! Noah! Graciously, God intervenes in Noah's life. Noah finds favor. It's a wonderful expression. It's an expression used through the Old Testament about a lesser person talking to a greater person and saying, well, if I found favor in your eyes, if you've been gracious to me, If you've looked down on me, even though I don't deserve it, and done something good to me, then I'm grateful. Think about someone in the New Testament who used that expression. A young lady, Mary, is visited by an angel and she's told she's going to give birth to the Saviour of the world. God intervenes in grace. She finds favour. It's the same expression used in Luke's Gospel. She finds favour in the eyes of God. God's like that, isn't he? Just when you think, how depressing. There's a world of evil then, there's a world of evil now. How desperate. God intervenes in grace. God does this. It's light in a dark world. Something we don't deserve, something we don't seek. How we thank God this morning for the intervention of grace. If you're feeling at all the weight of sin in society, in the world, if you're feeling anything of the pain, then you will feel the delight, the joy, the boost, the surprising thing that grace is. And you'll want to say this morning, thank you so much for your grace. Lord God, I didn't seek it. I didn't deserve it. I didn't look for it. Nothing in me said God should be gracious to this person. But to many of you this morning, God has been gracious. And we praise him for it. God sees a world of evil, but he intervenes in grace. And just briefly for a few moments, the second thing is just to think about how that works out in this person's life. Just begin to look at that. Verse 9 begins, this is the account of Noah. That's a place marker that the writer of Genesis uses to sort of introduce a new section. So the writer's given us an overview. There's evil in the world. God's showing grace to Noah. So he does that. And then he kind of looks at it from a world perspective and says, well, what actually happened? What's going on down here on the earth? And he talks to us about Noah, how God speaks to him, and what he does. And Noah demonstrates the work of God in his heart by believing God's unbelievable warning, God's unbelievable promise. Noah expressed wonderful faith, doesn't he? He's given some instructions and he's given a promise and a warning that must have been quite extraordinary. God says to Noah, verse 13, I'm going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. I'm surely going to destroy both them and the earth. That's a word of judgment. So Noah hears that. He's scratching his head and trying to take that in. And then God says, verse 14, so make yourself an ark of cypress wood, make rooms in it and coat it with pitch inside and out. And this is how you're going to be saved. So God comes with a word of judgment, I'm going to judge the world. And he comes with a word of salvation, I'm going to save you and your family. And I'm going to do it by this thing that you've never seen before. It's called an ark. And it's going to be this big and it's going to have rooms, actually called nests, where the various animals are going to rest and you're going to have to put some food in it. So there's some detailed instructions for you that you need to follow. But basically, believe me, build a boat. Because there's a flood coming. Something not known by weathermen at that time. A boat, something no engineer had ever built. Maybe a long time to wait. And yet Noah responds in faith. He's given an unbelievable word, but he believes despite all appearances. Is God really going to judge? And if God is going to judge, and if the world is that bad, is God really going to save? But Noah believes. And how do we know he believes? Well, because he acts, doesn't he? He builds an ark as instructed. God gives some detailed instructions. Noah, maybe with some help from his sons, maybe with some help from some other people, he builds this ark. What happens when God intervenes in grace? What happens to you when you hear the gospel? What kind of a message do you hear? when you hear the gospel? Well, you hear a message of judgment and salvation, and what have you got to do? You've got to believe and you've got to respond, just like Noah does. Noah hears about judgment and salvation. You this morning hear about the judgment of God. I've already tried to describe to you that God's view of the world then is the same as God's view of the world now, that we are corrupt, that we follow our own ways. And if this continues, God will ultimately judge everyone. We hear this word of judgment, and you need to believe it. But also, you can hear the word of salvation, where God says, if you want to be rescued from the judgment, here's a solution. And it's not even as complicated as Noah had to do. Not so many detailed instructions about how to build the ark and what to coat it with and how many rooms and how many decks and whether to have a window at the top of the door. It's just this: believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and be saved. Jesus Christ dies to pay the penalty for sin. You put your trust in him. That's your salvation. And now here's the thing. Are you going to be like Noah? Are you going to say, it's a pretty unbelievable word because things seem to be going on as normal? People seem to be living and dying and kind of nothing changes. It all cycles around. It's a pretty unbelievable word about judgment, but I'm going to believe it. And actually, it's a pretty unbelievable word about salvation because I'm not better than anyone else. And why should Jesus bother to die for me? And how does that all work, really? It's a pretty unbelievable word about salvation, but you know what? I'm going to believe it because God says it. And do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to throw myself at Jesus. I'm going to put my trust in Jesus. I'm going to get into the ark and I'm going to trust Jesus for my salvation when the judgment comes. What are you going to be like this morning? You're going to be like all the people who, as we're going to look at next week, are judged, or are you going to be like Noah, who responds in faith and action? He says, I believe, so I'm going to act. We don't hear anything else about any of the other people after this chapter, do we? Because they're all wiped away. But Noah and his family continue. Do you want life with God? Do what Noah does. Trust, obey.